This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 79 was recorded on September 7th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We've received several listener requests to interview a guest with a secular bearish view on the U.S. dollar to provide a contrasting view to the many dollar bulls that we've interviewed in past shows. Patrick is working hard to line up a few dollar bears for our 2017 fall lineup, and we're delighted to kick the series off with Luke Groman, who will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Luke's views are eye-opening, to say the very least, and I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. I, for one, found it to be extremely informative. A couple of announcements, though, before we dive into this week's show. First, we'll be releasing next week's Macro Voices 2 days early on Tuesday evening, rather than our usual Thursday evening format.
It's a guest you won't want to miss, mateys, so be sure to tune in on Tuesday evening.
Now, the reason for the change is to accommodate Patrick's travel schedule, as he's beginning a live speaking tour. So our listeners in Western Canada in particular should definitely stay tuned for our post-game segment after today's feature interview with Luke Groman to find out where you can meet Patrick live and in person in coming weeks.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's take a look at this market. Now, for the last week, we've more or less had a pretty range-bound S&P. But what's particularly interesting, something I've been noting to a lot of my members, is the fact that the market breadth is not really participating. And particularly, there's sectors like the financial sector is just not upticking at all during this most recent rise on the S&P. It's really interesting to see whether the S&P 500 could really push to new highs or whether this is just a retest of the highs in some big topping formation. What's your feeling here on the market?
Well, Patrick, the thing that blows my mind is we are looking at not one, not two, but three more major hurricanes bearing down on the United States. Irma is the most powerful Atlantic hurricane in recorded history. And to be sure, there's a little bit of exaggeration in that statement because recorded history really means since we've had weather satellites since about 1960. But in the last 57 years, it's the strongest storm there is. Not far behind Irma comes Hurricane Jose, another serious hurricane. Looks like it may recurve back out to sea, but we don't know that for sure yet. It could follow and strike right behind Irma and hit the United States East Coast. Just when it seemed like these two hurricanes were recurving a little bit more to the east, so at least Houston would be spared, enter Hurricane Katia, which looks like it's tracking right towards Houston. Now, Harvey alone was a contender for the worst U.S. insurance loss on record. Irma is going to be much worse. We don't know what Katia and Jose are going to bring. Some estimates say that parts of South Florida may be uninhabitable for months. Meanwhile, the western United States is engulfed in wildfires. The North Korean situation remains tense. Kim continues to make bold threats against the United States. President Trump, by siding with Democrats on the temporary debt ceiling bill, may have permanently alienated and damaged his ability to work with his own party, and stocks rallied on the news within 20 points of all-time highs. So it just blows my mind, Patrick, that this is happening. And I think this kind of complacency, where you see so many things wrong and stocks are still within 20 points of all-time highs, I think we're getting, you know, definitely into that very late-stage bull market where people stop listening and bad news gets reinterpreted as good news. I do think that probably the fact that there appears to have been a solution that at least temporarily averts a debt ceiling crisis or a risk of a defaulted treasury bond payment is probably the reason that we're seeing this strength. But I don't know how much longer it can last. And as you say, the breadth that we're seeing in the market suggests that maybe it's coming to an end.
Eric, let's move on to that dollar index. Now, the dollar index once again broke down heavy, largely because of a pop in that euro, as Mario Draghi's comments were coming out this morning. What's your take on where the dollar index is heading next?
Well, we're trading on a mid-91 handle now, so well below that 92, whatever it was, 35 prior support level. A lot of technicians, more technicians I'm seeing now, talking about 87.50 being in the cards. I'll tell you, though, I have said in the past in this program, I've yet to hear a really credible secular dollar bear argument. Well, we're about to hear one now because Luke Groman really makes a good case. It opened my eyes. I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this interview. Would I buy back into the long side of this at 87.50? I was definitely leaning towards that. I'm going to take today's interview into consideration before finalizing that decision. I think it's very likely that we would get a bounce. If we get down to 87.50, which is still several points away, it's hard for me to believe there's such a long-standing trend line there at that level. If nothing else, it's got to be good for a bounce. A lot of people will be buying that. So at least as a short-term trade, maybe as a longer-term trade, that would be the buy-the-dip moment if we get there. In the meantime, listen carefully to what Lou Groman has to say today.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. Now, last week we talked about those fib zones around the 46 handle on crude oil, and so far it's held pretty well. We've moved up toward $49. I'm sure the hurricanes have something to do with this oil pricing, but what's your take on where the prices are going next?
Well, before we dive into the inventory, I want to just again reiterate what I said last week, which is I don't think our EIA inventory numbers are really that relevant this week or next week or the week after that. And the reason is simply that the system has been kicked so badly out of equilibrium that these numbers just don't have the usual meanings. But in any case, crude oil was a build of 4.6 million barrels. That, of course, because the refineries have been offline. Now, as much as 4.6 million barrels sound like a big build on inventory, remember that as of last week, at least, there was still 25 to 30 million barrels of oil waiting to get into port. A lot of that's going to come into port next week. I think we'll see an even bigger build next week. On the other hand, refineries are coming online. They're going to be consuming as much as they can as they get back up to speed. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 797,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 3.2 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 1.4 million barrels. U.S. production very understandably down 750,000 barrels to 8.71 million barrels per day. But of course, that's a result of the temporary shut-ins. Almost all of that production is back online now. So I think we'll be back up to 9.5 million barrels within the next couple of weeks. You know, again, the next few weeks, inventory reports, though, won't be that relevant as far as price is concerned. I think the rally probably ends here at a 49 handle. I wouldn't be surprised if we test 49.50 or maybe even $50. The 200-day moving average is floating along there at about 49.57. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we touched that before this was over. But I'd really be surprised, unless there is some new news to justify it, to see us go above 50 here. We're looking right now, we're flirting here on both the daily and weekly charts with channel resistance levels. Unless something major happens, I think we're going to roll over and head back to the downside. But again, there's so much going on, and who knows what could happen with these hurricanes. You know, you could see anything from Florida being completely clobbered by the effects of Irma to a last-minute recurving where it goes into the Gulf, to Irma going out to sea and, you know, Katia intensifying and hitting the refineries again. There are so many different variables here that the price of oil could really go any direction. All other things being equal, though, I think we're probably done with this rally.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. And at least from a technical perspective, I have to be really impressed with the way gold's been advancing. Almost every time we have one of these one-day downticks, the buy-on-dip traders are now finally buying dips on gold. Obviously, we have a lot of geopolitical variables that are certainly contributing to their driving this trend. But what's your thinking here in terms of where gold's going next?
Oh, this chart really looks bullish to me, Patrick. And, you know, gold has held on to its gains, even as the debt ceiling risk has, you know, it hasn't gone away, but it looks like there's at least a temporary solution. North Korea definitely hasn't gone away, but it's kind of on simmer for the last few days. We haven't had any big new escalations of tension there, and gold is holding on to its gains. I want you to definitely, though, to listen to Luke Groman. You remember what I've said before is it's hard to get super bullish about gold unless you can justify a bearish argument on the dollar. Well, if anybody's got a credible argument that is secularly dollar bearish, it's Luke Groman. So I think you'll find the interview very interesting. But even for reasons that have nothing to do with the dollar, listen to what Luke says about the gold-oil ratio. And if he's right, it's definitely a very gold bullish story. Now, I do think that you could see a pullback here if North Korea blows over, if there's a resolution there, particularly if the dollar index bounces. We could see a pullback maybe to 1280 or 1300. That would be a buying opportunity. I would definitely be looking to buy that one in a heartbeat.
And finally, let's take a look at those 10-year Treasury yields. We continue to see downticking as we've now approached that 2.05 level. Where do you think interest rates are going here next?
Well, as I said last week, if we broke 212, I thought it would be a quick ride down to 2%. I didn't think it would be this quick, frankly. We're more than halfway there at 2.05. The immediate target downside in yields would be 1.98. Then the next level after that is 1.82. I think we're probably going to get there. I don't know how long it will take. At some point, this economy's got to roll over, and as we do get into a recession, it's going to take us lower. Whether we ever get to a Raul Paul scenario, you know, 50 basis points or sub 1%. Jury's still out in my mind, but I'm not going to be at all surprised if at some point we do retest that, what was it, 1.36, I think was the low yield last year that was the all-time record. I wouldn't be surprised if we still see lower yields, but it's probably going to take us a while to get back down there.
Thanks for the market wrap, Eric. For this week's featured interview, we're kicking off the fall All-Star lineup with Luke Groman from Forests for the Trees. Eric's interview with Luke Groman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
We've had so many secular dollar bulls on the program that you, our listeners, have asked us to find a credible secular dollar bear to present a contrasting view. Joining me now is Luke Groman, founder of Forest for the Trees. And folks, I think you're going to find that Luke's very bearish secular dollar arguments are as credible as they come. Luke sent us a fantastic 45-page book of graphs and charts to support this interview, which you're definitely going to want not to miss. Registered users at macrovoices.com will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com and click on the red button above Luke's photo that says looking for the download. Luke, before we dive into your chart book, let's start with the high-level executive summary. Why are you bearish on the U.S. dollar, not just right now, but as a secular trend?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Eric. I've been excited to do this interview with you. So why we're bearish on the dollar is because a key driver to the dollar bull market that began in earnest in 3Q14 has been accelerating de-dollarization trends. In other words, the dollar began rising so fast in 3Q14 because it began to lose share of global trade at an accelerating rate in 3Q14, driven by moves led by China and Russia. Now, ironically, what is in the long run the most fundamentally bearish development for the dollar, loss of share of global trade, was in the near term extremely bullish for the dollar as the reduced flow of dollars over a large and persistent bid for dollars from offshore dollar-denominated debt created what was, in effect, a massive dollar short squeeze that began in earnest in 3Q14. However, as we noted, dollar loss of share is a long-term, massively bearish development for the dollar. And so the only questions were always, number one, how high would the dollar go? And two, when will the tipping point be reached where the dollar's share loss in global trade go from being dollar bullish to dollar bearish? And what most dollar bulls don't realize, in our opinion, is that the tipping point was already reached a year ago in 3Q16 when the U.S. Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, said that the U.S. federal deficit as a percent of GDP was going to widen year over year for the first time since 2009. This was a critically important announcement that virtually every analyst totally missed. You can see why this is so important if you look at slide 29 in the packet. Since 1969, the U.S. federal deficit as a percent of GDP has peaked and fallen year over year only seven times. Six of those prior peaks were followed by U.S. recessions within 12 to 18 months. The only time the U.S. did not experience a recession, the dollar was significantly devalued at the Plaza Accord in the mid-1980s. And so last year in 3Q16, the U.S. CBO gave us the heads up that an indicator that for the past 50 years had indicated with 100% accuracy either a U.S. recession or a major dollar devaluation was coming had just been tripped. And right on cue, as you can see in slide 12, in late 2016, U.S. trailing 12-month Treasury receipts or tax receipts fell year over year for the first time since the recession, something that had never happened outside a U.S. recession in data on tax receipts that stretches back to at least 1980. And so in a nutshell, what the widening in U.S. federal deficits and the ensuing year-over-year drop in U.S. tax receipts meant was that for the first time in ours or any dollar bull's career, the U.S. fiscal situation, quote unquote, broke in response to the stronger dollar and rising rates before a major emerging market crisis broke out. This has led to a kind of unique situation where a core tenet of the dollar bull's belief system is the dollar will keep rising because the Fed is hiking rates and the U.S. economy fiscal situation has never broken before emerging market nations or currencies have suffered a crisis. But the data objectively shows the U.S. fiscal situation has already broken before the emerging markets did. It reminds me a bit of the situation in housing when you had a core tenet of the housing bull case was U.S. home prices have never fallen nationally when they'd already begun to do so. And so to directly answer your question, once we saw that widening in the U.S. federal deficit as a percent of GDP for the first time since 2009, we began to become a bit nervous about what was at that point a strong dollar bull viewpoint that we were holding. And then once Trump became elected president, having run on what was at its core a weak dollar platform, and then he and his administration nearly immediately began making extremely dollar bearish comments, we switched our position from dollar bull to dollar bear.
Okay, fantastic summary overview. But let's come back now towards the beginning of your chart book. You know, politicians love that old mantra that budget deficits don't matter. And despite the objections of all the sane people in the room, they've gotten away with that by running monster deficits for decades now. That leads, of course, to public complacency. People think that deficits really and truly don't matter. So, Luke, please explain why you think that budget deficits are going to matter a whole lot more going forward. And please describe the three options that you foresee for coping with the problems that you think are about to arise.
Absolutely. Vice President Dick Cheney reportedly famously said, Reagan proved deficits don't matter. He said that circa 2004. And critically, Cheney was right. For as long as global central banks are willing to sterilize U.S. dollar outflows or U.S. federal deficits as FX reserves. However, if at any point in time global central banks just stop sterilizing dollar outflows or stop stockpiling FX reserves, U.S. deficits will begin to matter again for the first time in 70 years. And as you can see in the chart on slide 10, exactly that happened in 3Q14. In 3Q14, there's that date again. In 3Q14, for the first time in 70 years, global central banks became net sellers of FX reserves. Nobody alive that is trading in markets today has ever seen this happen. Again, virtually everyone ignored this momentous development. But it was a development that the BIS had known would come for 37 years, per the quote we have at the top of slide 11. The second oil crisis could be worked through slowly, but the international financial system could not survive a third oil crisis. The inflation would make it impossible to recycle the petrodollars to the oil importing countries with any hope of repayment, trade would crumble and the system would be brought to its knees. BIS Chair Yael Zylstra said that in 1980. And so as was foretold in the quote 37 years prior, in 3Q14, the world stopped recycling petrodollars, which means for the first time in decades, U.S. deficits began to matter again. This then implied, to answer your follow-on question, this implied one of three things. U.S. had to do one of three things. Option one is the Fed would have to raise rates regardless of the U.S. economic situation in an attempt to drive foreign capital into treasuries or possibly crash global markets trying to do so, which would also force a safety bid for treasuries or dollars, which would thereby fund the U.S. government if only for a brief time. The second option would be that the U.S. government must accelerate its efforts enforcing banks, pensions, money market funds to buy treasuries while also pushing even more entitlement costs, which are the U.S. government's biggest line item for expenditures, push more of those entitlement costs onto U.S. citizens. Or number three, the Fed must renew QE in amounts big enough to fund the U.S. government, which we would estimate the starting point of being $100 billion plus per month, or otherwise massively devalue the dollar. And so in 3Q14, the U.S. began doing both option number one and option number two. It raised rates despite an economy that was really in no shape to absorb rate hikes, which can be seen on slide 12, which shows the Fed raising rates into a collapse in U.S. tax receipts for the first time in at least 37 years. At the same time, the U.S. government used regulatory changes to force U.S. commercial banks, U.S. money market funds, and U.S. pensions to buy more treasuries to pick up the slack from global central banks that were no longer net buyers of treasuries. And importantly, anyone that is well-versed on emerging market economies will recognize some of these steps as something emerging markets typically do when they begin to come under accelerating fiscal pressure and begin heading towards a balance of payments crisis. They raise rates, they force banks and the domestic private sector to fund the government, etc. Additionally, the U.S. government also began shifting its biggest expenditure, healthcare and entitlements, onto the private sector via ACA or Obamacare. And so in late 2014, U.S. consumers began seeing pronounced rises in U.S. healthcare premiums, copays, and deductibles, cutting into U.S. discretionary spending at a time when virtually everyone on Wall Street thought U.S. consumer spending was set to accelerate as a result of the collapse in oil and gas prices. All of the actions the U.S. government took served to, quote unquote, crowd out the global private sector, and this contributed to the rise in both the dollar and in LIBOR, which both began to rise sharply in 3Q14. Now, all of these steps that the U.S. took to fund itself, which, again, are steps traditionally taken by emerging markets under fiscal duress, they can all work, but they can only work for as long as the steps to reduce U.S. government deficits do not crowd out the private sector to such an extent that they actually begin to reduce U.S. tax receipts. At that point, steps to reduce U.S. government deficits will actually result in higher U.S. government deficits. And as we noted earlier, that began to happen in 3Q16 when the CBO said federal deficits would widen as a percent of GDP for the first time since 2009. What this means is that at that point, options number one and options number two that we highlighted were mathematically guaranteed to lead to a U.S. balance of payments crisis for as long as global central banks continued to not sterilize dollar outflows by stockpiling FX reserves, let alone keep net selling FX reserves. And that meant that post 3Q16, the only way out for the U.S. was option number three, either a renewal of QE in very large amounts to fund U.S. deficits, or although otherwise known as helicopter money, which, curiously enough, Ben Bernanke began floating trial balloons about in articles in 2Q16 in what was at the time advertised as a strong economy, or a devaluation of the dollar.
I want to come back to your comments about the petrodollar, because this is something I've been following for years. You know, Sergei Glazyev and Russia talking about de-dollarization. And I've seen quite a bit of chatter on the internet over the last couple weeks about a new crude oil contract that will be denominated in Chinese yuan, but it will also be convertible into gold. Now, on the surface, it sounds like it's really just a novelty because, you know, who outside of China has any yuan that they want to buy oil with? But you theorize that there's something much more interesting going on here. So please explain why you believe that this new oil contract may have actually been designed with the premeditated intention of enabling several different key actors around the world to change their business model completely.
Absolutely. Yes, I do. I really think there is something much more going on. And in a nutshell, China is effectively reopening the Bretton Woods gold window at a floating gold price through yuan to try to gain the ability to print yuan for oil. To our eyes, accomplishing this is a matter of national security for China because it realized post-2008 that when push comes to shove, the U.S. is going to have to print the $100 trillion-plus in entitlement obligations that it owes U.S. baby boomers. And if oil is only priced in dollars globally, when that happens, that's going to hyperinflate the price of oil in China and globally, leading to domestic social problems for China, a loss of monetary policy independence for China, and high rates of inflation and social unrest globally. We've argued that a warm-up for this could be seen in 2011 when food inflation was a contributing factor to the Arab Spring. And that was with, quote unquote, just $3.5 trillion in Fed balance sheet growth. If oil is only priced in dollars when the U.S. begins printing the $100 trillion-plus it needs for entitlements for its baby boomers, it would pose a severe challenge for China, Russia, and other emerging markets, and it would also completely decimate the real oil purchasing power of China's seemingly large $3 trillion in FX reserves. And what I mean by that is that Western investors, we all tend to be dollar-centric, and so we all look at China's FX reserves in dollar terms, but there's a lot to suggest China looks at those FX reserves in oil terms. And while $3 trillion in FX reserves buys China a lot of oil today, China knows that if oil is only priced in dollars, after the U.S. is done printing $100 trillion-plus for entitlements, China's $3 trillion in FX reserves will buy them much less oil. And for a nation that is short oil and food and certain other imports like China, that's a big problem. And so I ultimately think what seems to be a novelty in this contract is a much bigger geopolitical move, which is getting China the ability to print yuan for oil and gain their monetary and political independence from the Fed and from the dollar.
Okay, now let me just make sure I've got this straight in context. It sounds like you're saying the 45-year-old petrodollar system, where the profits that are made from oil by the Arabs, it's all priced in U.S. dollars and it gets reinvested in U.S. treasuries. A lot of people think that the primary reason the U.S. dollar has been able to retain its global reserve currency status for decades after the 1971 collapse of Bretton Woods is specifically because of that petrodollar system. It sounds to me like you're saying that this new yuan-denominated crude oil contract was basically designed to kill the petrodollar system. Is that right? And if so, what do you think the odds are of them succeeding at accomplishing that goal?
I don't know if that was the goal in setting up a yuan-denominated oil contract and reopening the Bretton Woods system through yuan at a floating gold price was designed specifically to kill the petrodollar. But regardless of intent, that is effectively what it'll do. You know, if you remember, under the Bretton Woods, the dollar was the U.S.'s currency and the U.S.'s problem through the gold link. In other words, the U.S. promised to settle all offshore dollar balances in gold on demand at, you know, first what, $35 an ounce and then $42 an ounce. Once we closed the gold window, of course, there was the famous Treasury Secretary Connolly quote, which is, the dollar's our currency, but it's your problem. What China and Russia, and by the way the euro is set up, but that's a separate discussion, but what China and Russia have set up is a currency system like the dollar was from 1946 to 1971 under Bretton Woods, which is, it's our currency and it's our problem. If China manages the yuan irresponsibly under this system, creditors, which by virtue of China's trade balances tend to be energy and commodity exporters, those creditors can show up with any offshore yuan balances and bid up the price of gold. And importantly, a rising price of gold will strengthen the yuan, not weaken it like the dollar. And it will strengthen the Chinese economy to the extent that they hold gold at the sovereign level. It helps take them out of their dollar position. To the extent they Chinese commercial banks own a lot of gold, a rising price of gold will help Chinese commercial bank capital levels. And then the Chinese people own a lot of gold, something the Chinese government has reportedly been encouraging for a number of years. And so to the extent China needs to make a transition from a mercantile export-driven economy to one that is more consumption-driven, a rising price of gold, if their people have some gold in their pocket, helps accelerate the growth of a Chinese consumer class. And so I think it is really about setting up a system that is set up the way the dollar was pre-1971, pre-petrodollar, which is, it's our currency and it's our problem.
So what is all this going to mean for the U.S. dollar's ability to retain its reserve currency status? I mean, the lion's share of international oil transactions is a huge percentage of international trade in general. So if we were to abandon the dollar in favor of this gold convertible yuan-denominated pricing, what happens to global demand for euro dollars? And what does that mean in terms of the United States' ability to continue financing its government spending and entitlement programs with deficit spending, which, of course, is the point we started with at the beginning of your chapbook?
Sure. You know, I don't think a lion's share of the oil transactions will go to yuan per se. I think it's important to caveat this with, one, we need to see how the yuan contract launches. We need to see, you know, is the yuan going to be convertible under this oil contract as intimated recently and as explicitly stated back in 2015. And of course, in the meantime, you know, the timing of renewed U.S. sanctions on Russia, Iran, and possibly Venezuela look conspicuously like trying to kick nations that might sell oil in yuan out of the dollar-centric financial system to try to disrupt things. Ironically, that may only serve to accelerate matters. With all that said, if the yuan oil contract launches and is convertible, as recently intimated and explicitly stated in 2015, the global need for FX reserves, you know, which are heavily dollar-denominated, they'll be structurally and permanently reduced. And the importance of this can be seen in the chart on slide 21. China holds FX reserves equal to 26% of GDP. The U.S. holds FX reserves equal to just 0.6% of GDP. Why the difference? One reason, because the U.S. can print dollars for oil and other critical imports. If China gets the ability to do the same, China's need for FX reserves will be structurally and permanently reduced. That 26% will move towards 0.6%. over time. I'm not saying it will automatically get there, but it is going to go lower in all likelihood. That will structurally and permanently reduce funding of U.S. government deficits at a time that U.S. government deficits are about to accelerate secularly and meaningfully due to baby boomer demographics.
Okay, so if I look at some of your slides here, it looks like the whole idea around this oil contract is it's going to change the gold-oil ratio dramatically. So what does that mean for investors and traders? Is the trade opportunity a pure bullish view on gold? Is it a pairs trade that's long gold and short oil? Because after all, oil's already been beaten up pretty badly over the last couple of years. So it seems to me like putting new money to work in a secular long-term short trade on oil is probably going to be hard for a lot of traders to rationalize. How do you see this translating to a trading strategy?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in a nutshell, the trade is long gold, short oil. And what China's doing moves gold back to being the reference point of oil for the first time in 46 years. But importantly, gold was oil's reference point for the 108 years before 1971, back to shortly after the Civil War, through the gold-backed sterling and then the gold-backed dollar. The important thing here, though, is if gold is going to become the reference point for oil again or increasingly, physical oil markets are some 12 to 15 times bigger than physical gold in annual dollar production terms, which tells us the oil price of gold, or the gold-oil ratio, or GOR, as we'll refer to it here, must rise significantly. If you look back in the some of the slide deck, and that's one slide I don't have numbered, and I apologize, but pre 3Q14, the gold oil ratio had consistently trading in a 10 to 20 times ratio. In other words, 10 to 20 barrels of oil per ounce of gold. Post 3Q14, it's never gone below 20. So there's been a re-rating higher already, and ultimately we think it will continue to re-rate higher. And so as we said, we think the trade is long gold, short oil. From there, further derivative trades off of that get political. And by that I mean, the key question is, does the U.S. want to have a domestic energy sector? If the U.S. thinks strategically that importing all of its oil is a good idea, then if this yuan, this multi-currency oil pricing and the gold link continue to gain traction, dollar gold prices don't have to rise a whole lot. Oil will drop notably. And so gold, flat gold, oil down a lot will drive the GOR up. And the U.S. will have to import all of its oil, and the dollar might not have to weaken much and might actually strengthen a little bit if gold falls under that scenario. However, we think the U.S. not only strategically but economically needs a robust energy sector, not just for energy and industrials and on the defense and national security side, but to make things like Tesla and solar viable, you need expensive oil. And so if the U.S. needs higher oil, then under what China and Russia are forcing, the GOR must rise by gold rising a lot and oil rising less, but still a lot possibly underneath it.
Let's come back to the three options that you mentioned earlier, Luke. It sounds like you think there's a good chance we could get pushed into a corner where really quantitative easing is the only way out. Now, a lot of people would say, look, 8 years ago, all the naysayers said that there was going to be, you know, hyperinflation and all these problems. But in actuality, it really didn't cause that many problems at all. Quantitative easing appears to have worked. So can it work the next time around, and what problems might we encounter if we were to engage in another big round of quantitative easing in terms of being able to fund government deficit spending and so forth? Is that going to work this time around, or is it a different picture?
I think it could work, but I do think it's a different picture. I think it could work. At any rate, it certainly, in our opinion, wouldn't be dollar positive, even if it worked the way it worked last time. But I would point us back to the global FX reserve picture, which back then the world was still growing FX reserve stockpiles. They were still sterilizing dollar outflows. And so remember, when we printed that money, there was no inflation here. There was a lot of inflation in China. There was a lot of inflation in the Middle East. Everywhere where there were dollar stockpiles growing, there was a lot of inflation. Those dollar stockpiles aren't growing anymore. And so what effectively the process of what we've described in terms of the implications of what of falling global FX reserves, of what this oil contract would do. Effectively, if you think of QE as a hose of liquidity, back when we did it the first time around in 08, that hose was spraying the world. It sprayed China, it sprayed the Middle East, etc. The rest of the world, by virtue of the process and what they have done, that hose has now been bent around and stuck in through the United States basement window. And so we can do it, but I think the next go around, you will see inflation that will be much more in line with what the naysayers feared the first time around, if global FX reserve balances do not rise enough to compensate for the increased U.S. dollar outflows.
Speaking of things that the naysayers predicted the first time around, you know, a lot of people, myself included, predicted years ago that someday the really big foreign holders of U.S. Treasury paper, particularly China and Japan, would start to divest those holdings. And a lot of people, including me, predicted that that was going to result in a disaster for the U.S. Treasury market. But look what's happened. China and Japan did divest exactly as we predicted. And they've been dramatically reducing their U.S. Treasury holdings. But not only did the Treasury market not crash, instead, we're to this day within 1% of the all-time record low yield on the 10-year, which, you know, was actually set a year ago after China and Japan started divesting. So how is this possible? What's going on here? And, you know, why will it be different next time around?
Sure. Yeah, and that's a great point. I think there's a number of things at play. I think, you know, somebody, a good friend of mine who's a veteran macro trader, sent me a fascinating chart yesterday showing the G4 central bank balance sheet. So Eurozone, Bank of Japan, U.S., PBOC. That balance sheet is now in aggregate nearing $20 trillion and is basically a straight line up and to the right at 45 degrees. And so they're, to the extent that, you know, capital flows are open and you've got the differentials in rates, there's certainly, I think that has been a big contributing factor to what has happened. Secondly, remember a point earlier, the U.S. private sector has, since 3Q14 in particular, been essentially forced to buy treasuries via regulatory changes in commercial, on the commercial bank side, on the money market side. And then you've also, of course, had this sort of global private sector continuing to buy in a reach for yield. And additionally, U.S. retirees who've been buying for demographic reasons. If you look at the TBAC, the Treasury Advisory Committee, the whale bid for long-dated U.S. paper has come from U.S. investment funds, which by virtue of who holds the wealth in this country, shades towards, you know, the older demographic. And, you know, it's interesting as I look at all of those or many of those as sort of a side note, they may all be right. To me, something that jumps out at me as I try to kind of look at the forest for the trees is U.S. retirees, commercial banks, and pension funds are all on the right side of a major macro trade well ahead of time. It would be probably the first time I can remember my 22-plus-year career on Wall Street. And I don't mean to be trite, but the reality is none of those investor groups have historically been known for being leading indicators of major macro trends. So it'll be interesting to see. But to answer your question directly, I think it's the combination of G4 balance sheet expansion. It's some of the regulatory actions the U.S. has done. It's a global private reach for yield. And it's also some demographics in the U.S. and other Western social democracies that are buying for safety reasons.
You know, something I've said for years is the real end game starts when we eventually someday face runaway inflation, because that's the point where you can no longer solve your problems by just printing more money out of thin air. But almost everybody in finance seems to be convinced that deflation is the risk. We've got nothing to worry about from inflation. And then when I try to argue that it's mathematically impossible for the U.S. national debt to ever be paid back in real terms, so therefore treasuries really aren't the safe haven asset that everybody seems to think they are, people just shut me down and they tell me I'm crazy. They tell me that U.S. sovereign debt will forever and all time be the safest investment on earth and will therefore always be the target of the so-called safety trade away from risk assets in times of crisis. Do you buy that story, or do you think that maybe they're stuck in thinking that's going to change?
You know, when I hear you describe that, you know, something that jumps to mind is that curiously, since the second quarter of 2013, according to World Gold Council data, global central banks have bought more physical gold than they have U.S. Treasury bonds, which is an interesting statement in the context of what you just described, right, about what they may think is the safest investment on earth. And, you know, maybe they've begun to downgrade U.S. Treasuries to second safest, but, you know, who knows? If they have, I do think Treasuries will remain the second safest investment on earth on a nominal basis. And you know, what is it they say about those that ignore history being doomed to repeat it? You know, I say that because it's not well known what the Fed did the last time U.S. federal debt to GDP was above 100%. But this can be seen on slides 37 and 38 in our packet. You know, in November 1941, the U.S. was 12 years into deflation. The U.S. economy was weakening again. Deflation was coming back. Treasuries were an easy one-way trade. 2 weeks later, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. The Fed told the Treasury it would buy all 10-year treasuries issued at 2.5%. And no holders of treasuries lost a dime from 1942 to 1951 as the Fed pinned yields at 2.5%. Well, they didn't lose a dime nominally, of course. In that time, stocks rose 5x in those 9 years. CPI rose 3.5x. And so treasury holders got destroyed on a real basis. And I expect this type of action, which really began in 2009, to continue from here and possibly accelerate. given how important U.S. stock prices are to consumption and to tax receipts through capital gains and options expirations, I think this must happen to avoid a much worse outcome. And furthermore, I think in certain areas, high inflation has already begun. 3 years ago, my family's health insurance premium cost me $400 or 0.4 treasuries per month. Now they cost me $1,100 or 1.1 treasuries per month. And I think that trend will continue. I think you've kind of seen high rates of rent and tuition inflation continue as well. And so I think when it comes to necessities like that, you're likely to continue to see rates of inflation that trend well above reported levels of CPI. Something I do find interesting in the context of this discussion and of the history is, if you take a 30,000 foot view, to me, it appears the regulatory authorities have spent some time in the last 3 to 4 years making something of a Hotel California out of the bond market, right? You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. I've never traded bonds, but from what I can tell from what I've read, liquidity has fallen pretty notably, some of it regulatory driven over the past few years in the bond markets. And so it begs the question, what happens if bondholders wake up one day to some sort of significant dollar devaluation, which is historically how these types of things happen? Can they sell all at once? To whom? Is there enough liquidity? I don't know. To me, if the dollar takes enough of the brunt of that pain, I would think rates would have to rise, but perhaps not that much if the dollar really takes the pain. I'm not sure that that will be like the early 1980s in that regard.
For more than a decade now, I've been convinced that eventually, someday, and probably in our lifetimes, we're going to have to go through a really, really big reset. And what I mean by that is that the predictions that Robert Triffin made 50 years ago about the U.S. dollar eventually losing its reserve currency status would be proven correct, and we'll be forced to come to terms with the reality that, no, you really can't get away with doubling the national debt every 8 years the way that we've been doing for the last several presidential terms. And I predict that eventually, someday, we'll have an outright crisis in the U.S. Treasury market as people figure out that these paper promises in the form of debts that are mathematically impossible to repay in real terms. Of course, you can repay them nominally, as you said, but in real terms, they can't. They've got to be profoundly mispriced. When everybody thought it's the safest, most indisputably stable asset on earth, and in the reality of the situation is it can't be repaid in real terms, I've predicted that that could lead to a really serious social unraveling, really, really big deal, bigger than the 2008 financial crisis, closer to something like the 1990s collapse of the Soviet Union, although I don't know it would create a government collapse. I think it could create an economic collapse. But, I've been persuaded, Luke, that these ideas that I have must be quite a ways out, at least another decade before something of that scale starts, because we really are seeing that the stock market's recovering, the economy is to some extent recovering from the 2008 event. So please correct me if I'm misinterpreting you, because frankly, as I listen to this interview and go through your slide deck, it sounds to me like the real message here that you may be giving us is that big end game that I thought was still a decade off might have already begun. And of course, these things happen slowly. But I think you're saying that some of the things that I saw leading to a loss of U.S. dollar reserve currency status and that having a number of follow-on implications, it sounds like you're saying maybe that's already beginning. Am I right to think that? Or is that a mischaracterization of your view?
The short answer is no, I don't think it's a mischaracterization of our view. Our analysis that we've done suggests that without a significant dollar devaluation, U.S. fiscal problems are likely to become acute by 2021 or 2022, possibly earlier if the U.S. enters a recession. And there's two charts on slide 35 shows some of that math, and it importantly allows the reader to play around with some of the assumptions. But the chart on the left of that slide shows U.S. federal revenues growing 2% CAGR. It grows entitlements at 6% CAGR, which is what they've been plugging along at for a number of years. It grows defense expenditures at 1% CAGR, and it grows interest expense at $22 billion a year, which is flat interest rates and only $1 trillion a year in debt growth, and it's been growing $1.2 trillion CAGR for the past 6 or 7 years. But if you use those assumptions, your big three expenditure items become more than 100% of federal tax revenues by 2021. If you assume just a very modest recession and you'd have revenue growth 0.5% only, not even down, but just 0.5% growth CAGR, You bump up entitlement growth to 9%, which is what Medicare has been growing CAGR, but not Social Security. And then you don't change anything else with defense or with interest expense, you get big three expenditure items above federal revenues by late 2018. And so that is everything else then has to then be spent. You're talking about $1 trillion plus deficits on a run rate basis exiting 2018, which I'm not sure a lot of people are doing that math at this point. You know, regarding the social fallout, and, you know, most on Wall Street don't see it. You know, they tend to live on the coasts. I live in sunny, beautiful Cleveland, Ohio. So it's interesting. I already see the fallout, the social fallout. I think you've started to see, you know, one of the things that really moved us from being bearish or bullish the dollar to bearish is the first thing to break was on the populism side. You've seen a sharp uptick in political populism with Brexit, Trump. And to us, the biggest message of that is I think there has been this overriding belief that entitlement reform would get done someday in the United States and in other Western social democracies. And I think the overriding message of the political populism that has broken out in the United States and Western social democracies over the last 6 to 12 months is those are going to get paid. And I think that's what maybe Mr. Market is starting to discount. You've seen a breakout in, you know, the S&P 500 over the, you know, over the TLT, the long bond ETF, very pronounced breakout on a 25-year chart. You've seen the social costs already. You know, last year, 65,000 people died in the United States from drug overdoses. The Wall Street Journal called those deaths of economic hopelessness. That is an echo directionally of what happened after the Soviet Union broke up. In my hometown, you know, we've gone from 5 OD cases in 2014 to 48 in 2016 to 73 year to date. And this is a median income, median home price, median education, middle America type town. And so, you know, I agree with you. Could it get worse if mismanaged? Yes, it could be very bad. But I'm ultimately optimistic. If we look at what we talked about before, that what is happening appears to be a breakdown of the petrodollar system. The petrodollar was really good if you were associated with what I have called the dollar export business. Really good for the dollar export business, really bad for manufacturing. Really good for Washington, really bad for flyover country. It's gotten to the point where in 2012, the Washington Post noted 7 of the 10 richest counties in America are around Washington, D.C. There was an article a couple months ago in an auto magazine that noted that of the 25 biggest U.S. Metropolitan areas or MSAs, 24 of them could not afford a traditionally financed average new car with the median income in each respective MSA. The one MSA that could afford a new car, Washington, D.C. And so my point is that dollar exorbitant privilege has become an exorbitant burden to 24 of 25 MSAs. It's only a privilege anymore to Washington. It's why Trump won Michigan. It's why Trump won Ohio. It's why he won Pennsylvania. It's why he won Wisconsin. If the dollar loses reserve status, and in my opinion, it could be epically bullish for U.S. dollar risk assets, U.S. dollar gold, energy, industrials, emerging market currencies, emerging market stocks, very bearish for the dollar. And it probably doesn't work out too well for people holding treasuries. And it probably doesn't work out well for those people most close to the dollar export business, which the biggest beneficiary of the last 30 years, 40 years has been Washington, D.C.
Well, that's sobering perspective, to say the very least, Luke. Finally, though, before we close, please give us the quick overview of what you do at Forest for the Trees and tell our listeners where they can follow your work.
Absolutely. Yes, thank you. So we started FFTT 4 years ago. FFT stands for Forest for the Trees. After 22 years as a partner at two different equity research firms in the Midwest, and what we do is aggregate large amounts of data from disparate publicly available resources, trying to identify developing economic bottlenecks, because it's been our experience throughout our careers that excess returns on a macro and sector basis accrue to those sectors positioned to benefit from economic bottlenecks. And, you know, obviously, we think we've found one of the biggest economic bottlenecks in a generation or more here in what we talked about today. You know, if you're interested in learning more about FFTT or a couple free samples, you can go to our website at www.fftt-llc.com.
And people can also follow you on Twitter at Luke Grohman. Luke, I can't thank you enough for an absolutely outstanding interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, what a great interview with Luke Roman. What really does put into context is the challenges the U.S. faces as the world unwinds from global U.S. hegemony and as the world diversifies away from petrodollar dominance. What was your takeaway from that interview?
Well, it was a fantastic interview, I thought. It surprised me. It was much better than I expected. I want to thank the listeners, several listeners, actually, who recommended Luke to us. And it really struck a chord for me because, you know, about 10 years ago, Patrick, when I was really starting to learn heavily about macroeconomics, I made a rookie mistake, which is I realized some things are inevitable, and those things include the dollar has to someday lose its reserve currency status. We cannot continue to just stay in this cycle we've been in of doubling the national debt every 8-year presidential cycle. Eventually, the piper has to be paid. And I made the mistake at that time, this is around 2006, beginning of 2007, before the financial crisis, of confusing inevitable with imminent. And I started thinking about the dollar collapsing and these things. Well, those things are, in fact, inevitable. We've reached a situation, I would argue, where the national debt cannot possibly be repaid in real terms. You can pay it back in nominal terms by inflating away its value, but you can't pay it back in real terms because it's just gotten so big. The thing is, there was nothing imminent at that point. So doing something like shorting treasuries would be exactly the wrong move back in 2006, 2007. And I kind of came around to the view that, okay, this has to happen someday, but I need to wait for there to be clear signs that it's actually happening. And I started looking at what indicators I should watch. And the biggest one that I try to watch for is someday we're going to see the U.S. Treasury yield moving up, which would normally bring on a stronger dollar, but we'll see the dollar moving down because it won't be a U.S. Treasury yield which is reflecting a strong economy, and that's the reason it's going up. It'll be going up because of increasing default risk as people realize that the U.S. does eventually have to lose its economic hegemony over, you know, the entire world. But that's a someday, and we haven't seen those signals yet. Another thing that I was really watching for was big foreign actors like China and Japan divesting their treasury holdings, and I thought that would bring about some kind of bond market crisis, and of course, it happened, and it didn't, and I kind of had to say, okay, the things that I thought could go so seriously wrong, the signs I've been waiting for are not really playing out. Well, Luke's presentation today is the first one that I've seen that really makes compelling arguments. This guy is not a crackpot conspiracy theorist by any stretch of the imagination. He makes really solid arguments backed by data saying that these things that I've predicted for 10 years, but I thought were still a ways off, he feels have already begun to unwind. And I think it is very important to be cautious not to, you know, get into conspiracy thinking. It's not as if, you know, the world is going to come to an end tomorrow or the sky is falling or anything like that. But Triffin's paradox has to be resolved some day. The U.S. dollar cannot stay the world's reserve currency forever. When it loses that status, it's going to spell a huge fiscal crisis for the United States, and I predict a treasury bond crisis. I was thinking, you know, that that's still 5 or 10 years off, maybe towards the end of the fourth turning cycle that we talked to Neil Howe about. And you heard Luke say that he thinks by 2020, 21, 22, in there someplace, we could be looking at that scale of crisis. So this is the first evidence that I've seen that these things that I've predicted for a long time may actually be starting to happen. But before we go on, I want to fill our listeners in, Patrick, on the details of your upcoming speaking tour in Western Canada.
Yeah, well, thanks, Eric. Each year, I'm one of the speakers at the TMX Options Education Day that tours to all the major Canadian cities. And the tour starts this year with shows in Vancouver and Calgary on September 16th and 17th. So any of our listeners that are local to those cities, please make sure to check it out. You can find the registration links on the respective TMX.com or the Montreal Exchange's m-x.ca websites. But we'll also include a link in the Research Roundup email. And now while I'm out in Vancouver and Calgary, I always do additional presentations promoting bigpicturetrading.com. Now for this show, I'll be covering the topic of understanding how Warren Buffett utilizes selling options to generate premium income and to accumulate stock positions. So you can sign up for that on the bigpicturetrading.com website or as well. Well, I'll include a link in the Research Roundup email. And while we're on the subject of media appearances, you were just interviewed on Chat with Traders podcast with Aaron Fifield. Listeners, you can find a link to hear the interview with Eric on the other side of the microphone in this week's Research Roundup. Now, Eric, give our listeners a sense of what they'll hear when they do click on that link.
You know, I really enjoyed this one, Patrick. I talked to Aaron off the air ahead of time. He was hesitant to do the interview. He feels like because he doesn't have a macro background, he didn't think he was qualified to interview a macro trader, and he was hesitant to do it. And when we did the interview, he asked better questions than almost anybody I've ever been interviewed by. So for Chat with Trader regulars, you should help me and encourage Aaron that he should do more macro interviews. I think Kevin Muir and I are the first two macro guys that he's done, and I hope he does more. It was a great interview. We talked about everything from cryptocurrencies and my views there to fourth turning and how I apply it in my investment process and a bunch of other things. So it was a fun interview, and I hope our listeners enjoy it.
Now let's switch to a completely different topic now. We got so much positive feedback when we covered your own investment process in some of the recent post-game segments. And so I wanted to kind of continue along those lines. Now, Kyle Bass was quite outspoken in saying that one of the most important things to figure out in macro is how to size positions in your portfolio. So let's tackle that this week. So how do you go about figuring out your position sizes in your trades?
Well, Kyle obviously is an absolutely brilliant investor. I tremendously respect his investing acumen. Now, as far as choosing which podcast invitation to accept for Labor Day weekend, that's an area where maybe his judgment could use some improvement. But kidding aside, folks, in case you're not aware, Kyle is co-hosting Adventures in Finance with our friends at Real Vision Television. We're sure that Kyle will be accepting our invitations, which have been outstanding longer than theirs have. Hint, any day now. But until then, let's get back to position sizing. I think he totally has the right priority in terms of how important this is. And my strongest value in this area is it has to be based on conviction. A lot of people really subscribe to this idea, you know, you should have 10 even-weighted trades at all times or something for the sake of diversification. I don't believe that at all. I think that you always need to take your confidence and your conviction about an idea and use that to weight how much you put at risk for it. Now, the way I go about it is I start by asking myself what I admit is a completely subjective question, which is, how much am I willing to lose being wrong about this? And you can't ever get into the mindset of, oh, but I know I'm right. You've always got to say, I'm going to be proven wrong. What percentage of the portfolio am I willing to write that letter to my investors saying, I lost this much of your money because I was wrong about this idea? Now, I'm not particularly scientific about how I go about that. It's a subjective call. But what I do is I come up with that number, then I put it aside. I don't think about it. I look at a chart and I say, okay, for whatever my view is, whatever the trade is, at what point is the market telling me conclusively that I got it wrong? And that's where the stop goes. Now, I never base that on loss tolerance. It's always based on where, based on what I thought the theory was for why I thought the trade was going to go one way. How far can it go in the other direction before it's time to admit that I just plain called it wrong? Whatever that point is on the chart, okay, that's where the stop goes. From there, it's simple arithmetic to calculate what position size is going to result in that size loss at that stop. From there, you can incrementally model multiple entry points. So you start, you know, scaling into a position at a certain level, adding more to it at another level. That allows you to get more leverage on while still having the same total loss at the same ultimate stop level. If you want to get really fancy, you can even model it with multiple stop levels. If you think that there's reason to, you know, reduce your confidence at one level and lose confidence completely at another level. I very rarely do that, though. It's usually one point where it's time to give up on the trade. So there's one stop loss point, and there's usual multiple incremental entry points in order to get there.
And how does that approach, though, differ from how others do this? Or maybe put another way, what are the pros and cons of how different people approach this that you care to opt in on?
Well, I think that if I was to criticize my own approach, I'm not particularly scientific about choosing what that loss number is that I'm going to be willing to live with if I'm wrong about a trade. A guy who's written quite a bit about this is a guy named William Zimba, who wrote a couple of books about Kelly bets and so forth. And it was curious to me. He points out in his books that sports bettors and gamblers, you know, Las Vegas gamblers, are actually more disciplined, in his opinion, than Wall Street. Street in terms of using math to really figure out optimum position sizes. But in order to figure out an optimum position size mathematically, you've got to know probability. So if you're dealing with a game of chance, you know, roulette or something, you can calculate what the ideal bet size is because you know those probabilities. Now, if you don't know for certain what the probability is, you have to use your conviction, your subjective opinion about how confident you feel in your opinion of the trade in order to come up with, I guess, what you could call an implied probability. And, you know, that's, again, somewhat subjective. But it is possible to mathematically model an optimum position size. I admit, though, I don't do it that way. The way that I do it is I think about what number can I envision putting in that letter, telling my investors how much of their money I lost by being wrong about something. And I come up with that number based on how strong my conviction is that I'm right about it.
Well, you know, Eric, I find that really interesting, but I have my own perspectives on how I kind of look at it because, you know, when I hear someone like Kyle Bass saying that, you know, it's all about position sizing, I kind of look at it and it's like, listen, there are some big money players out there. And those big money players, let's say you're Jeffrey Gundlach or Kyle Bass and you're turning around and you're managing billions upon billions of dollars, you have different considerations than you do if you're a small trader. And when I mean by small trader, I'm not even talking about even a $20,000 or $50,000 account. I'm talking even if you have, you know, $10-20 million in a family office and you're trading that money, you don't have the same constraints because when you're managing big money like billions, things like liquidity and counterparty risk and all of these things are huge considerations. Especially you can have liquidity going in, but you don't have liquidity coming out. But when you're a smaller trader and you're trading millions, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, you can pretty much go in and out of the market almost unnoticed. It's one of the few advantages that small traders have. That can be further augmented by the fact that you can overlay options. And, you know, options, if you're doing them over the counter in big size, then you also have liquidity constraints. But when you're engaging the exchange traded options market, you have often the ability to come in there and hedge positions and change the risk reward propositions of a trade, which allow you to do it in a completely different context than the big money traders do. To give you an illustration, you know, often like I took a position recently in the gold miners ETF. And when the thing rose, I bought it somewhere in the $22 and change range. And when the stock rose to $24, I turned around and I bought a protective put and I hedged out and locked in a $24 sale price. So, I mean, I've basically found with an option overlay over a stock position to find a way to remove almost all risk of loss at that one moment in the trade. How do you have to kind of be able to look at this in a different perspective when you're a smaller trader.
Well, and I think that really just brings me back to something we've talked about before on this program, Patrick, which is you hear so many people that are new to this that are saying, oh, I want to learn to be like Warren Buffett. I want to learn to be like Ray Dalio. I want to be like Kyle Bass. I want to be like Jeff Gundlach. No, you don't. You want to learn those few things that you actually have an advantage over those big guys. And as you say, liquidity, being able to just get out of your position without taking days in order to do it because of the effect you'd have on the market. You need to learn what those few advantages that you have are. And as you say, you can do things very quickly. You can get, you know, entirely into or out of a position with one mouse click if you're a smaller trader. And that really is an advantage. So, you know, it's about learning where your edge is, not trying to emulate the rock stars. But we're going to have to leave it there in interest of time, Patrick. I want to remind our listeners again that we will be releasing the show early Tuesday night. You don't want to miss that one. So tune in to Macro Voices Tuesday night. Patrick, I am jealous of your trip to Vancouver, definitely the best dim sum in North America. But what we need from our listeners right now, if you like these really big names, we've got a fantastic one coming up for you next week. And, you know, Luke Groman this week, the reason we're getting these big names is because people are doing their part and registering their free accounts at macrovoices.com. More registered users we have, the more able we are to recruit the very best guests. So please sign up if you haven't already. You'll get the research roundup email, which gives you nothing but a compendium of links to free cool stuff like the download from Luke Groman's interview today. Never contains any advertising or marketing. If you can, use our donate button. And we've got some really big names coming up in the next several weeks, including some more secular dollar bears. So we'll see you next Tuesday night. Meanwhile, Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, the first thing you're going to find in there is that transcript for today's interview with Luke. I mean, I'm looking forward to just sitting back down with a cup of coffee and really reflecting on some of Luke's insights over the weekend. In addition to that, there's the slide deck that Luke and yourself were referencing during that interview. Now, there's an interesting Forbes article written by Gordon Chang about Donald Trump considering embargoing China over North Korea. There's also a link to the CNBC interview with Jean-Claude Trichet suggesting that the euro rally is actually a dollar problem. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVR our hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, at Macro Voices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.